You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode, I'm talking to Canadian director Vincenzo Natali about his work, from his renowned low-budget science fiction debut, Cube, through lesser-known works such as Nothing and Cypher, to his new film Splice, starring Adrian Brody and Sarah Polley as scientists who use genetic modification and gene splicing to create a dangerous half-human hybrid, which is in cinemas now.
Well, this is your fourth feature film, and the fourth that you've done with David Hewlett, and the fourth that's also a genre film.
Right.
So there seem to be
I've evolved very little.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that at all, but there certainly seem to be themes in your work that are ongoing.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. And in fact, David and I have, this is our fourth feature film together. We've been doing this since we were about 15 years old.
Mm.
So this is really a lifetime worth of work. And we're partners. He's a great friend, a great actor, and I think even if you looked at my early Super 8 stuff, it wasn't all that different from what I'm doing now.
In terms of the themes of man versus technology, or just ideas of perhaps playing with genre in unexpected ways as far as the audience is concerned?
A little bit, yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't think I was very self-conscious about it at the time, but no, I've had these interests my entire life, really, and so it's been a very slow but steady progression of work over the years.
Cool. I mean, where did the idea for Splice first come about? Because compared to your other films, they seem to be more about mechanical technology, while this is more about biology.
I think that this film is a little different from my usual kind of thing, because aside from dealing with a slightly different kind of technology, it really is a movie that is driven by the characters. The other films are very situational. The characters discover that they're in an extraordinary situation and they have to find some way out or come to grips with it. In this case, really all the decisions that are made that move the story forward are made by the protagonists. And so I think it's a bit of a departure, but, you know, I guess there's some similarities. I try not to think too much about this stuff because
sure.
I think it's dangerous. You can start to do things because you think you should do them, not because it feels right. But I will say this, Splice has been with me for a long time. I mean, I had intended it to be my follow-up to Cube.
Okay.
And it just took this long to actually put the financing together and get the film released. But I guess, you know, it resonates with me. I think that I've always been fascinated by monsters, for lack of a better word. And this film really speaks to that. In a way, this is kind of my love letter to creature films.
Sure. Well, the fact that you've called the two main actors after the two actors from Bride of Frankenstein.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it very self-consciously references James Whale's films, and I think there's lots of bits and pieces of other things mixed in there, which hopefully add up to something greater than the sum of its parts. But it definitely owes a debt to those movies, and I mean, in terms of how it relates to Cube and so on, I think there's just, I guess I like with my science fiction to have a mixture of all kinds of things, and I love genre movies, but when I have the opportunity to make one, I always want to mutate the genre. So I think that, similar to Cube, I think that Splice hopefully pushes this kind of movie in a slightly different direction, and does so by emphasizing the human relationships, and in a sense it becomes, I think, kind of a chamber piece, which in a way Cube was as well, as was Nothing, and my third film. So, I guess it follows. It's part of the, you know, it's a close member of the family.
I think I read that one of the inspirations for the film was when you saw footage of a mouse with an ear that's been stitched to its back in order to grow presumably human tissue on other species.
Right. Yeah, it was a thing called the Vacanti mouse, and it was quite a famous experiment. It was done at MIT, and what they actually did was they took this thing called a nude mouse, which is a kind of mouse that doesn't have any hair and has a very weak immune system, and they put an armature under the skin and grew cartilage cells from a cow over the armature, and the effect was it looked like a human ear was growing out of the mouse's back. And it was just such a shocking image. I felt there had to be a movie in that mouse. And I was really struck by how vulnerable the mouse seemed. And so from its very early stages, Splice was really always about finding the humanity in the monster, and then conversely finding the monster in the humans. That was very much, you know, what that mouse brought to the movie. The mouse didn't make it into the movie in the end, but it had a real impact.
Well, I mean, one thing I've noticed with your films is that you actually seem to be ahead of the curve with, in terms of the genres that are popular at the time. For example, you made Cube, which is sort of like the torture porn genre, in the sense that it's characters that are imprisoned in a locked room and they're being tortured by their environment. And then you have like the Saw franchise, which comes along and is massively popular. And while Cube is a cult hit, it obviously didn't make $100 million. And then right. Something like Cypher, for example, touches on some of the same themes as Inception. And while Cypher, in my opinion, deserved a much larger audience, again, it's a bit of a cult hit. So I wonder if that was one of the reasons why you couldn't get funding for Splice for a while, is you kind of needed to tap into the zeitgeist at the same time as the financiers were available, rather than sort of doing it 10 years ahead of that.
Yes, my timing isn't great. I know, I specialize in doing things that are obscure. You know, it's funny. It's a constant source of frustration for me because I so desperately want to make films with a larger budget. You know, every one of these movies, including Splice, are done quite economically. In some cases, for a very small budget. And I don't do that out of choice. It's only because that's the only way I can make the movies I want to make, you know, with freedom. And I have to say I've turned down opportunities or haven't pursued things that, you know, could have been much more lucrative but just weren't all that interesting to me. And there really doesn't seem to be any great reward for doing things that way, except that, you know, I do feel like I've been able to push the boundaries a little bit, and maybe I am a little ahead of the curve. But yes, it would be very nice to do something that kind of is in line with the times. And I actually think that part of the reason Splice took so long to finance was not only the fact that my other movies are not mega hits in the Hollywood sense of the term, or anyone's sense of the term, but also because at the time it just wasn't in the popular consciousness. Like, people, I think they had cloned the sheep, perhaps, but it really wasn't, you know, out there. And I think by the time Splice did start to gather momentum in around 2006, it was really in the newspaper every day. There was just, you know, the science had evolved exponentially from the time when I started working on Splice. So it, you know, the real world kind of grew into my movie. And I hope the timing is right now. I mean, it's just hard to say. I think Splice is a very, you know, pushes buttons. That's what I've definitely found here in North America, because it's been released here, is that there's a segment of the audience that really loves this film, but there's another segment that is just absolutely horrified by it. Like, they don't, you know, it just doesn't sit well. So I don't know if this film's going to net me a huge financial success. I don't know. We'll see. I hope so. I hope it does well in the UK. I have very high hopes for it. Because I in the UK, because I think the taste there, particularly as it relates to science fiction, is quite sophisticated, and I think we also have an excellent distributor.
Yeah.
But it's yeah, it's no, you've touched a nerve for me because it's been a source of frustration. That's why I haven't made more movies. It's not that I haven't. It's not for lack of trying. You know, I've worked on a lot of things that just I could never get off the ground, and I think, you know, that's part of the reason. Guillermo del Toro, who's our executive producer on the film, said something to me that was quite poignant. He said, "Filmmakers always look ahead, and studios always look behind. They always look backward."
Yeah, I think that's very true.
It really is. So it's hard, especially when it comes to genre. For some reason, it's a very they're particularly conservative when it comes to horror films, which I guess Splice, you know, belongs to that category.
Which is bizarre because kind of the definition of a horror film is something that's subversive and unsettles the audience.
Exactly. That's what I think good horror films do. But but it really is a very, it's a formula here. I'm in Hollywood right now. It's a formula. It's also a formula that works. So the idea of doing something that is a break from that paradigm does not sit well. And I think that's part of the reason I had so much difficulty with Splice, because it truly does, you know, on one hand it is very much a Frankenstein type story. I mean, there's a lot there that I think is familiar, but then the movie veers off in another direction, and I think, you know, that's where I had some difficulty. But I wasn't interested in doing the conventional version. You know, it's just what would have the point been? You know, anyway. But I'm lucky. It actually got made by some miracle. So I don't want to complain. I'm very, very happy.
Well, I think one thing that's very interesting about Splice is that it deals with the relationship that a scientist has with its creation. That's something that perhaps a lot of these monster movies don't deal with. Quite often, all you get is Victor Frankenstein waking up with a monster at the bottom of his bed and he recoils in horror, while you deal with perhaps the idea of fascination and attraction towards one's creation, which is something that a lot of other films in the genre completely shy away from.
Oh, thank you. That's a really good point. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, Mary Shelley's original book does go into the relationship quite a bit, but it is a very antagonistic relationship from the very beginning. And you're right, with Dren, with our creature, it's a kind of familial relationship. I mean, in a sense, that's what the film is about, is sort of my worst fears about parenthood. and so there's a lot of things that go terribly wrong in the relationship, but essentially it's a one based on, you know, love. And the creature, in a sense, is very beautiful. So I think the movie, it's funny, you know, some people pick up on them and some people don't. But that, to me, is truly what distinguishes it and what made it exciting for me to make as a filmmaker.
Well, I mean, I wondered if one of the reasons why you had trouble getting it financed until Guillermo del Toro came on board was that because in the film you deal with issues of incest, with paedophilia, with bestiality, in, you know, even in quite a subtle way, because it's an impossible creature. But at the same time, I think anyone, you know, who's intelligent enough to appreciate what the film's about will see that you're dealing with some very uncomfortable subjects that a lot of people would prefer to not, you know, talk about at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it took a French company to finance the film, because they didn't have a problem with those things at all. They thought that they were selling points. I don't think they saw it in those terms exactly, but they definitely thought that the sexuality was what made the film exciting, and I don't think that an American company could ever come to that conclusion.
No.
That was definitely what scared them.
And I, you know, not wanting to paint your country of origin with a wide brush, but it does seem that Canadian films in particular deal with the subject of human sexuality and a lot more interest and incisiveness than perhaps their North American cousins. Because if you look at, say, the films of David Cronenberg, Robert Lepage, Guy Maddin, all of them deal with skewed sexuality at one point or another, and you seem to be following in that tradition, at least with this film, if not your others.
I know, it's an odd thing. I think even for Canadians, we're sort of puzzled by that. seems like an odd thing to be proud of, but it is one of the things that distinguishes our cinema.
Mm.
And believe me, I didn't do this in a self-conscious way. I didn't set out to make a you know, typical perverted Canadian movie.
It's not something they teach you at Canadian film school, then.
No, at least, or maybe I just blocked out those memories. Yeah, it's an odd thing. I don't know why that is. I've always felt that Canadian cinema was actually a little bit like Scandinavian cinema, in that it tends to be quite introverted, whereas our American cousins are definitely extroverts. They look outside themselves, and they're usually, on some level, movies about the individual fighting some external force, whereas Canadian films, I think, invariably are about some kind of internal struggle. And I wouldn't really know exactly why that is, except to think that perhaps it has something to do with living in a very cold environment and spending a lot of time indoors. I'm not sure. Or maybe even it's something to do with the, you know, psychology of the way the country was formed, because we didn't really, you know, the Americans kind of went out and individually fought for their land, whereas in Canada we sent out the mounted police and it was all done in a very formal, legal kind of manner. You know, we're a society that doesn't necessarily embrace individuality in quite the way the United States does. So I don't know. I don't know. It's definitely real. I mean, it's definitely, you know, look at Adam O'Goyne's movies, for instance.
Yeah.
Like it's sort of a defining factor. And there's no question that's part of what makes up Splice's DNA.
And also, the idea of your characters having a degree of madness to them. I mean, the environment in Cube sends at least one of the characters in that environment mad. The lead character in Cypher is an unreliable narrator. Both the lead characters in Nothing may be crazy. And again, you know, in Splice, your scientists are not only power mad, but make very unethical decisions as the film goes along.
Right. Yeah. Well, I truly believe that the enemy lies within. I think that, you know, if you want to see your greatest enemy, you merely have to look in a mirror, and that's what has to be conquered. So I think that's definitely part of the movies. All of them, they deal with that, and Splice especially so, because it kind of reverses the roles. You know, usually it's the monster that goes on a rampage, but in this case, it's really the scientists who do. Even though, on some level, they're actually quite likable people, and I quite like them. I like Clive and Elsa as characters. I admire them, and I intentionally chose Adrian Brody and Sarah Polley to play them because I think that they're very warm, likable actors, and they bring tremendous humanity to their roles. But there's no question that they do. Their characters do. Terrible things. So the other thing is, I just think that those kinds of characters are interesting.
Yeah,
they're just more fun to write and more fun to watch on the screen, because you really don't know quite what they're going to do next. I always look for that in movies. I love it when I don't know where the story is going to go, where I don't know quite what the characters are going to do next. And I hope that happens with Splice. I truly hope that this is a movie where, at a certain point, you just have no idea what's around the corner. And that would have everything to do with Clive and Elsa and their own, you know, personal neuroses.
Well, that, I must imagine, is one of the hardest things as a writer, is to come up with how humanity deals with genuine science fiction tropes, whether it's a monster or an alien invasion, because it's all very well that we've got 100 years of science fiction films behind us. At the same time, humanity never actually has been genuinely confronted with something alien.
Well, that's why I always co-write.
Okay.
It's hard. It is hard to write these things. I mean, I think that fantasy is very challenging. When I say fantasy, I sort of use that as the umbrella word for horror and science fiction and anything that's not real. It's always challenging to write because, on some level, you're creating a world, even if it's a contemporary world. When you bring these things, like a genetically altered being, into it, you have to invent rules, and you have to stick by those rules stringently, but you have to do it in a way that's dramatic and not overly expositional. And it just requires a lot of work, a lot of brain work. It becomes a real puzzle. And any screenwriter will tell you any screenplay is a kind of puzzle. But I think that is compounded when you're dealing with these sort of elements. And as you say, we have 100 years of watching these movies, and so there's sort of pre-existing expectations about what should happen or shouldn't happen, or you know, what a creature should look like, or what it shouldn't look like, and so on. And of course, as a filmmaker, you want to subvert those expectations or push the boundaries of what we've seen before. And so all of those things are really challenging. But then, of course, that's sort of what makes it so exciting.
And of course, fantasy films, successful ones, work on a level of satire and metaphor as well, which, again, must mean that whenever you're creating a film like this, as you said, you're kind of reacting to the times that you're living in.
I think so. That's why I'm so excited for science fiction in particular at the moment, because I think it's the genre that's most equipped to deal with this particular time wherein the world is clearly in a state of flux, and it's a very transitional period, I think, for the human race. And I think science fiction is just a great means to examine a lot of what's going on in the world in an indirect way, or in some cases, I guess, a way that is not so indirect. But it just seems like, I mean, I sort of, to quote William Gibson, I sort of feel like we're living in the future already. I mean, I feel like I am in a science fiction film to some extent, because so much of what had just been fancy, pure, you know, imagined things when I was a kid have now kind of come to pass. Every time I use my iPhone or I use iChat, it's just, I'm reminded that I really am in the 21st century. And so, it's kind of like, and I found that particularly with Splice, because when I started working on Splice, you know, it was very much a science fiction piece. By the time we released Splice, the Craig Venter, famous geneticist, had announced the creation of the first synthetic life form, which had been actually created in a way very similar to the way, at least in terms of its DNA, in a way that Dren had been made in the movie. So it was a very... it was constantly a process of coming up with ideas and then discovering that they were closer to reality than I had expected. So all this is to say that we're really, I think, in an exciting time, and in a very exciting time for this particular genre.
Well, and also because we're living in a time where it's corporations that are creating the science fiction that surrounds us. Because, I mean, you mentioned the iPhone. And there was so much excitement at the recent keynote presentation of the iPhone 4, when all it is a slightly different version of something we have already. And I think it's very telling in your film that I think the first time the scientists are confronted with the potential horror of what they do is when there's a public demonstration of the first two creatures and they go crazy and kill each other.
You know? It's like Steve Jobs' worst nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. If his iPhone went crazy and attacked an HTC console or something.
Yeah. I think the corporation in Splice, Newstead, which is also an allusion to Frankenstein, because that's the name of Lord Byron's estate where Mary Shelley wrote the book, or first conceived of the book, is fascinating because they don't really have any kind of moral perspective on things. I mean, I think it's a fairly realistic portrayal because they're really just driven by the bottom line. And their view of whether it's right or wrong to do this stuff is just non-existent. I mean, they're only concerned about what other people think and how that relates to how they can sell a product. And I think that's what frightens me the most about this kind of technology. I mean, speaking of genetic engineering, because I actually, in working with geneticists on the film, was very impressed and kind of reassured, because I felt that the scientists that I met were very dedicated people who were truly working to help their fellow man. and doing it for the love of science. They certainly weren't driven by the almighty dollar, because they don't make much money. What frightens me much more is how these sort of things can be commodified, and what might result from that. Because I think it's in that kind of context that things could really go awry.
Mm.
And, you know, we've had, of course, here in the States, this horrendous oil spill, which is totally the result of negligence on the part of the corporation, because they're driven by the bottom line. They're just trying to, you know, make as much money as they can. And when they're not very, very closely regulated, things get out of hand.
Mm.
So, So I the relationship to the corporation in Splice was always fascinating to me. And I suspect fairly accurate.
Mm. And I think it's interesting that the kind of science fiction genre that Splice falls within, the mad scientist thing, it's normally about these individuals who just believe that they should do something and they act on their own, when in fact, as you said, it's corporations that we should be more worried about. Because, I mean, there was that documentary that came out a few years ago, The Corporation, which
right.
applied the way a corporation works to the psychology of a human being and postulated that a corporation shows all of the attributes that you would associate with a psychopath or a sociopath.
Right. Yeah. And it was really fascinating because legally, corporations are defined as individuals.
Mm.
Yeah, I had no idea. I didn't realize that. It has the rights of an individual, essentially. But it's a psychotic. Yeah, I think that's where the capitalist system breaks down. That's where we get ourselves into tremendous difficulty, because it's just, you know, it functions purely to make money, and all other considerations are secondary. And you can just see what's happening to the planet as a result of that.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm not a communist, or I'm not opposed to capitalism in theory, but I think things like when you're dealing with the development of new life forms, that has to be very carefully regulated. And I personally would feel much more comfortable if it were kept in the public sector, because then you wouldn't have these pressures just to, you know, do this stuff for profit. And I think there's, you know, ethical issues to be considered when you commodify an organism, when you turn aspects of the human genome into patented pieces of property. I just don't think that life should necessarily be treated that way.
Mm.
It's such a loaded topic. It's so fascinating. I mean, on a certain level, you know, you could make an argument, well, why not? Because when you really start to understand how life works, I mean, it does boil down to proteins and chemicals, and it's just not, on a certain level, it's just not mystical at all.
Hmm.
There's nothing sacred. You could make an argument that there's absolutely nothing sacred about it, that it's no different than any other piece of machinery that we've made. It just has the capability of reproducing, but beyond that, it's, you know, there's really nothing particularly special about life. So it's really fascinating. I have very complex feelings about it. I mean, I'm certainly not opposed to this kind of research. I think it's vital, actually. It's very important. But I'm also keenly aware of all of the potential dangers.
Mm. You mentioned William Gibson earlier. And according to the internet, you've been attached to a production of Neuromancer as your next film. So since this kind of follows in the footsteps of your earlier film, Cypher, it suggests that corporate science fiction, which seems to be something that William Gibson deals with and very few filmmakers have so far, is something that you do have an interest in.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think ever since I saw Network
as
a kid, I've been affected by that speech that Ned Beatty gives in the film. I don't know if you remember, but it's a great speech where he says there are no countries. I'm paraphrasing, but he says basically there are no countries. There's just countries. There's only IBM and General Motors, and that was such a powerful thought. And I think, you know, there's some truth to it, and you know, increasingly so as time goes on. So I am fascinated by that, and I think that's a big part of what William Gibson sort of saw as our future, was the sort of breakdown of cultural boundaries, and that we would kind of become more citizens of different corporations, and those were truly the driving forces. So yes, Neuromancer definitely is about that partly. I mean, it's about a lot of things. I think that's why it's been so challenging for people to turn it into a coherent script, because it's just such a loaded book. There's so much going on in it, but it's been very exciting to work on. I'm really, really, really excited about the prospect of being able to do that movie. I'm writing this Neuromancer script. Like, it's just completely eaten up my life. Like, I can't think about anything else.
Well, no, I mean, I can imagine it's quite a challenge, and, you know, I hope it's going well.
Actually, it is. Yeah, I think it is. But actually, the thing that's tricky about it is the ending. The first two-thirds of it are, in fact, quite easy and are very faithful to the book. But the book, and William Gibson would fully admit this, doesn't really have an ending. So he said I airbrushed it in, and but in the movie he can get away with it in the book because the prose is so great, he writes so beautifully, but in a movie you can't end it like that, so that's been the hard part.
Great. Okay, well,
anyway, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you,
Vincenzo, speaking with you.
Yeah, you too.
To read my reviews of Vincenzo Natali's films Cube and Splice, please go to www.electricsheepmagazine.com. And to hear the companion podcast to this episode, in which I'm talking to actor David Hewlett about the four films he's made with the director, please go to www.sci-fi-london.com/podcast. Thanks for listening.